content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. For our first article today, I'm delighted to read Speaking of Music, written by Leonard Bernstein. This article was recently republished by The Atlantic, but it was written in the December 1957 issue, again by Leonard Bernstein. Ever since I can remember, I have talked about music with friends, colleagues, teachers, students, and just plain simple citizens. But in the last few years, I have found myself talking about it publicly, thus joining the long line of well-meaning but generally doomed folks who have tried to explain the unique phenomenon of human reaction to organized sound. It is almost like trying to explain a freak of nature, whatever that might be. Ultimately, one must simply accept the loving fact that people enjoy listening to organized sound, certain organized sounds anyway, that this enjoyment can take the form of all kinds of responses from animal excitement to spiritual exaltation, and that people who can organize sounds so as to evoke the most exalted responses are commonly called geniuses. These axioms can be neither denied nor explained. But in the general tradition of man burrowing through the darkness with his mind, hitting his head on a cave walls, and sometimes perceiving a pinpoint of light, we can at least try to explain. In fact, there's no stopping us. There have been many more words written about the Eroica Symphony than there are notes in it. In fact, I should imagine that the proportion of words to notes, if anyone could get an accurate count, would be flabbergasting. And yet, has anyone ever successfully explained the Eroica? Can anyone explain the mere prose, the wonder of one note following or coinciding with another, so that we feel that it is exactly how those notes had to be? Of course not. No matter what rationalists we may profess to be, we are stopped cold at the border of this mystic area. It is not too much to say mystic or even magic. No art lover can be an agnostic when the chips are down. If you love music, you are a believer, however dialectically you try to wriggle out of it. The most rational minds in history have always yielded to the slight mystic haze when the subject of music has been broached, recognizing the beauty and utterly satisfying combination of mathematics and magic that it is. Plato and Socrates knew that the study of music is one of the finest disciples for the adolescent mind, and insisted on it as sine qua non of education. And just for those reasons of its combined scientific and spiritual qualities. Yet, when Plato speaks of music, scientific as he is about almost everything else, he wanders into vague generalizations about harmony, love, rhythm, and those deities who could presumably carry a tune. But he knew that there was nothing like piped music to carry soldiers inspired into battle, and everyone else knows it too, and that certain Greek modes were better than others for love or war or wine festivals or crowning an athlete. Just as the Hindus, with their most mathematically complicated scales, rhythms, and ragas, knew that certain ones had to be for morning hours, or sunset, or Siva festivals, or marching, or windy days, and no amount of mathematics could or can explain that, we are still, in our own day, faced with this magical block. We try to be scientific about it in our bumbling way, to employ the principles of physics, acoustics, mathematics, and formal logic. We employ philosophical devices like empiricism and teleological method. But what does it accomplish for us? The magic questions are still unanswered. For example, we can try to explain the shape of a theme from a Beethoven quartet by saying that it follows the formal principle of synthesis, that there is a short statement, a thesis, followed by a questioning answer, antithesis, followed by a development arising out of the conflict of the two, synthesis. The Germans call this form Stollen. Others say syllogistic. Words, words, words. Why is this theme beautiful? There's the rub. We can find 100 themes shaped in this way or based on variants of this principle, but only one or two will be beautiful. When I was at Harvard, Professor Birkhoff was working hard on a system of aesthetic measure, actually trying to evolve a mathematical system whereby any object of art could be awarded a beauty rating on a given continuum of aesthetic worth. It was a noble effort, but when all is said and done, it comes to a dead end. The five human senses are capable of measuring objects up to a certain point. The eye can decide that X is twice as long as Y. The ear can guess that one trombone is playing twice as loud as the other. But can the senses be measured? Or can their aesthetic responses be measured? How far is the smell of pork from the smell of beans? What beans? Cooked how? Raw? In what climate? If the Eroica earns a grade of 3.2, what mark do you give Tristan? Or a one-page Bach prelude? We bumble. We imitate scientific method in our attempts to explain magic phenomena by facts, forces, mass, energy. But we simply can't explain human reaction to these phenomena. Science can explain thunderstorms, but can it explain the fear with which people react to them? And even if it can, somehow, how does science explain the sense of glory we feel in a thunderstorm? Break down this sense of glory into its parts. 3 parts electrical stimulation, 1 part aural excitement, and 1 part visual excitement. 4 parts identification feelings with the beyond. 2 parts adoration of almighty forces. An impossible cocktail. But some people have explained the glory of a thunderstorm, and such people are called poets. Only artists can explain magic. Only art can substitute for nature. By the same token, only art can substitute for art. And so the only way we can really say anything about music is to write music. Still, we go on trying to shed some light on the mystery. There is a human urge to clarify, rationalize, justify, analyze, limit, describe. There is also a great urge to sell music, arising out of the transformation of music in the last 200 years into an industry. Suddenly, there is a mass market, a tremendous recording industry, professional careerists, civic competitiveness, musical chambers of commerce. And out of this has come something called music appreciation, once feliciously called by Virgil Thompson the music appreciation racket. It is, in the main, a racket, because it is the main in the main, specious and commercial. It uses every device to sell music. Cajoling, coyness, flattery, oversimplification, irrelevant entertainment, tall tales, all in order to keep the music business humming. And in doing so, it has itself become a business. The next step is obviously a new parasitic development. Music appreciation, appreciation. The racket operates in 2 styles, depending on the audience involved, and one is duller than the other. Type A is the birds, bees, and rivulets variety, which involves anything at all under the sun as long as it is extra musical. It turns every note or phrase or chord into a cloud or crag or cossack. It tells homey tales about the great composers, either spurious or irrelevant. It abounds in anecdotes, quotes from famous performers, indulges itself in bad jokes and unutterable puns, teases the hearer, and tells us nothing about music. Type B is concerned with analysis, a laudably serious endeavor, but it is as dull as Type A is coy. It is the Now comes the theme upside down in the second oboe variety. A guaranteed soporific. What it does ultimately is to supply you with a roadmap of themes, of a kind of Baedeker to the bare geography of a composition. But again, it tells us nothing about music except those superficial geographic facts. The musical layman is harder put to find intelligent talk about music, but every once in a while someone appears who strikes an illuminating spark, who can give the layman some insight into music, if only into a cadence or a melodic contour or a single harmonic progression. Such people are rare and invaluable. Plato had some moments, as did Shakespeare. Certain critics can be perceptive and at the same time intelligible to the layman. Men like Sullivan and Newman and Thompson. Certain novelists like Mann and Huxley have turned out memorable paragraphs or even chapters on musical matters. But most novelists and writers in general tend to put their feet in their mouths whenever they part lips to speak of music. And they do it often. For some reason, literary minds seem magnetized by musical terminology, probably because they are awestruck by the abstractness of it all. Nothing can be more different from the representational literary mind with its literal conceptuality than the non-objective musical mind with its concentration on shapes, lines, and sonorous intensities. And this fascinates the writer, makes him even a little envious, I have found, so that he longs for some participation in that strange foreign medium. As a result, when he reaches for the elusive mot juste, he often winds up with glissando or crescendo to express what he means, precisely because the musical word seems so elusive. Besides, it's so pretty. What chic and grace those Italian words carry with them? Scherzo, vivace, andantino, crescendo. We are constantly running across the word crescendo in literature, almost always used synonymously with climax. The storm rose to a great crescendo. As they kissed, their hearts reached a crescendo of pounding passion. Nonsense. Obviously, crescendo can only mean growing, increasing, specifically, getting louder. So a crescendo can mean growing to a climax of storm or passion or anything you wish. But it can't be what you grow to. This digression is only by way of pointing out the rarity of intelligent musical talk, even among first-class writers. The Huxleys and the Manns of this world are few and far between. Huxley's description of part of Beethoven's Opus 132 in Point Counterpoint is unforgettable. Mann had some thrilling passages on music in The Magic Mountain and in Dr. Faustus. And because of people like these, who can sometimes evoke with words the quality of a piece of music or some sense of its essential weight or thrust, because of them, we musicians are encouraged to go on trying to elucidate in the hope that, even if only here and there, we can shed a little light on that terrible bugaboo, musical meaning. Meaning in music has preoccupied aestheticians, musicians, and philosophers for centuries. The treatises pile up and usually succeed only in adding more words to an already obscure business. In all this mass of material, we can discern four levels of meaning in music. 1. Narrative, literally meanings, as in Till Eulenspiegel and The Sorcerer's Apprentice. 2. Atmospheric pictorial meanings, as in La Mer and Pictures at an Exhibition. 3. Effective reactive meanings such as triumph, pain, wistfulness, regret, cheerfulness, melancholy, apprehension, most typically of 19th century romanticism. And 4. Purely musical meanings. Of these, the last is the only really important one, the one worthy of analysis. The first three don't actually involve analysis, but rather arbitrary justification or prettifying for the commercial reasons mentioned above. If we are to try to explain music, we must explain the music, not the whole array of extra-musical notions which have grown like parasites around it. which makes musical analysis for the layman extremely difficult. Obviously, we can't use musical terminology exclusively, or we will simply drive the victim away. We must have intermittent recourse to certain extra-musical ideas, like religion, or social factors, or historical forces, which may have influenced music. We don't ever want to talk down, but how up can we talk without losing contact? There is a happy medium somewhere between the music appreciation racket and purely technical discussion. It is hard to find, but it can be. It is with the certainty that it can be found that I have made so bold as to discuss music on television, on records, and in public lectures. Whenever I feel that I have done it successfully, it is because I have found that happy medium, and finding it is impossible without the conviction that the public is not a great beast, but an intelligent organism, more often than not longing for insight and knowledge. Wherever possible, therefore, I try to talk about music, the notes of music, and wherever extra musical concepts are needed for referential or clarifying purposes, I try to choose concepts that are musically relevant, such as nationalistic tendencies or spiritual development, which may even have been part of the composer's own thinking. For example, in explaining jazz, I have avoided the usual pseudo-historical discussions up the river from New Orleans, and concentrated on those aspects of melody, harmony, rhythm, which make jazz different from all other music. In talking of Bach, I have had to make references to his religious and spiritual convictions, but always in terms of the notes he produced. In analyzing Dvorak's New World Symphony for a lay audience listening to a recording, I have displayed all the thematic material as music appreciation would demand, but in terms of Dvorak's attempt at nationalistic results. In other words, music appreciation doesn't have to be a racket. The extra musical kind of reference can be useful if it is put in the service of explaining the notes. And the roadmap variety can be serviceable if it functions along some central idea that can engage the intelligence of the listener. Therein lies the happy medium. But in the end, we can never really interpret music through words or give even a shadowy equivalent. If it were possible for words to tell a Chopin mazurka its sad gay quality, the abundance of its brevity, the polish of its detail, why then would Chopin have had to write it in the first place? Well, pardon me for that very lengthy article, but I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Now, How Much Leisure Time Do the Happiest People Have? By Joe Pinkster. Up and down the economic ladder, many Americans who work, and especially those raising kids, are pressed for time, wishing they had more of it to devote to leisure activities, or even just sleeping. At the same time, research has indicated that people who are busy tend to be happier than those who are idle, whether their busyness is purposeful or not. A research paper released late last year investigated this trade-off, attempting to pinpoint how much leisure time is best. Its authors examined the relationship between the amount of, quote, discretionary time, quote, end quote, people had, basically how much time people spend awake and doing what they want, and how pleased they were with their lives. Some examples of discretionary activities were watching TV, socializing, going to the movies, spending time with family, and doing nothing. The paper, which analyzed data covering about 35,000 Americans, found that they employed people's ratings of their satisfaction with life peaked when they had in the neighborhood of 2.5 hours of free time a day. For people who didn't work, the optimal amount of time was 4 hours and 45 minutes. The research traced a correlation between free time and life satisfaction, but didn't provide any definitive insight into what underlies that correlation, which is exciting because this is a work in progress, says Cassie Mogulner Holmes, a professor at UCLA's Anderson School of Management and a co-author of the paper, which hasn't yet been peer-reviewed or published in an academic journal. Holmes's co-authors are her UCLA colleague Hal Hirschfeld and Marissa Sheriff, a professor at Wharton, the University of Pennsylvania's business school. The correlation that Holmes and her collaborators hit upon persisted even after they controlled for people's age, gender, race, parental status, and other demographic variables, though they did not calculate how the optimal amount of free time varied depending on these factors. The researchers write that their finding is a small effect, but still significant, considering that there are a slew of other variables that play into people's overall assessment of their satisfaction in life. An experiment that the researchers arranged hinted at a possible explanation of the correlation they found. They asked participants to picture and describe what it would be like to have a certain amount of daily free time and then report how they'd feel about that allotment. What we find is that having too little time, makes people feel stressed. And maybe that's obvious, says Holmes. But interestingly, that effect goes away, the role of stress goes away, once you approach the optimal point. After that point, Holmes said, the subjects started to say they felt less productive overall, which could explain why having a lot of free time can feel like having too much free time. It's not clear what an individual is to do with these findings, since the amount of free time people have usually has to do with a variety of factors, such as having children or a degree of control over work schedules. That said, Holmes told me that she shared her research with the MBA students in her class on happiness, and some of the most time-crunched among them were comforted by the findings. I think that 2.5 hours creates a nice goal that, even if you increase a little bit more of your discretionary time use, you can expect it will translate into greater life satisfaction. Daniel Hammermesh, an economist at the University of Texas at Austin who studies time use, said it can be difficult to suss out the relationship between free time and life satisfaction. For one thing, some of the data analyzed in the paper was obtained by asking people to estimate how much free time they have, and those estimates can be unreliable. For another, it's difficult to systematically say what qualifies as discretionary time and what doesn't. Every minute we have is subject to choice one way or the other, consciously or not, he notes. While Hammermesh didn't inspect the underlying data in the paper, he offered a couple of possible, but he notes hard to test, explanations for the findings. Let's say everybody around me has 2 hours of discretionary time, and for some reason I have 4, he says. I have no friends to play with. His point being that people's free time might be less fulfilling if they can't spend it with others. Another theory, having too much free time might challenge a person's self-image. For a man who provides for his family, Hammermesh says, if I have so much time that I can spend it on, I don't know, watching television, maybe I feel I'm not a real man. This feeling could be related to the pressure many people feel to appear useful and in demand as they vie for work in a competitive labor market. While overall life satisfaction is a metric shaped by many variables, Hammermesh said there's some research specifically on how stressed people are feeling about time. Perhaps not surprisingly, he writes in his forthcoming book, Spending Time, the Most Valuable Resource, any switch that increases time away from work reduces stress. Some of the biggest reductions in feeling stressed about time, he notes, come from substituting an hour of sleep or TV watching for an hour of work. For another thing, the studies show that studies show would likely affect people's well-being is, for those who can afford it, spending money to buy free time. For example, getting takeout instead of cooking, or hiring someone to clean the house instead of doing it yourself. Figuring out time use affects people's well-being can be difficult because getting experimental evidence would require people to upend their usual rhythms for the sake of the research. Still, Holmes says she's interested in studying how the sequence and structure of free time might affect the pleasure it brings. For instance, is it better to cluster it at the beginning of the day or end of one's day, or disperse it throughout the day? And on a larger scale, would people be happier with the standard 5-day work week or a week with 4 longer work days and a 3-day weekend? What about the time to go on vacation? Maybe Holmes wonders, happiness is not just about how much free time people have, but also when they have it. Now, a quick business article. When it comes to retirement savings, most workers are on their own. It's nice that some companies are nudging employees towards putting aside more for 401ks, but those firms are solidly in the minority. This was written by Teresa Ghilarducci. 401ks could certainly be improved. Notably, the fact that they're voluntary leads many to financial ruin late in life. But having one is generally good. The risk of being poor or near poor in old age falls slightly when a worker has some kind of retirement account. So it's good that some companies are increasing what their employees are nudged toward contributing. What's not good is that only 41% of private sector employees have any kind of pension plan at work, including traditional pensions and 401k-type plans. Essentially, employers are off the hook, and private sector workers are on their own. Most young workers, despite the great benefits of investing money early in life, aren't saving for retirement. Young workers can be forgiven for losing sight of such a distant savings goal, but it might be surprising that most people 10 to 15 years away from retirement don't have pensions or 401ks. Employers aren't required to sponsor retirement plans, and even if they do, they aren't required to contribute to it. So it's nice that a few companies are setting norms that encourage workers to save, but they are an exception to the rule of leaving everything up to the worker. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. I sure hope you listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.